Hello, my name is Brian Novoselsky, and welcome to the Over the Counter podcast. Today, we are joined by Antonio Chiapcha, president of 3-Axis Advisors and CEO of 46 Brooklyn Research. Antonio has shown significant expertise in pharmacy consulting and has extensively researched ongoing drug supply chain trends and challenges, namely the role of pharmacy benefit managers, or how most people know them, PBMs. Welcome and thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be with you.
Awesome. So as Antonio has said himself, he loves the profession of pharmacy, but hates the business of pharmacy. So today we'll dive deeper into the business side of pharmacy and discuss the current status of PBM control in the pharmaceutical supply chain. Can you start by summarizing the work you do in regard to PBMs and kind of how you got into your line of work?
Yeah, so I'm a former pharmacy guy, did about 10 years at the Ohio Pharmacists Association, and learned about drug pricing and PBMs from what is arguably the biased perspective of pharmacists who are on the receiving end of PBM reimbursements. Prior to that, I would have assumed that pharmacists, being the experts on the medications, also knew essentially everything there was to know about the pricing of medicines as well. What I learned over time is that, in essence, pharmacists are passengers in the drug pricing vehicle, with very little control over the end cost to the consumer and the plan sponsor. And over time, as I learned that pharmacists obviously, again, whether they're paid reasonably or not, there was a disconnect between what pharmacists were paid and then on the other end of the transaction, what was occurring from a plan sponsor's perspective, those that are paying for the drugs on behalf of government programs or employers across the country. In 2016, there were some major cuts to pharmacy reimbursements within the Ohio Medicaid program. As I was trying to understand why those cuts were occurring and asking state officials whether or not they made budget cuts that would resulted in those underpayments, what I learned was that they were spending more for medicines than they ever had. And so while I didn't know a lot at the time, those two things didn't make sense to me. If it's the same transaction and at the end of it, the amount is becoming less, but on the front of that transaction, the amount is becoming more, clearly something was being lost in the middle. So we started to download information from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, one, delineating the national average drug acquisition cost, which is a proxy for what pharmacies pay to acquire drugs. And then we also downloaded CMS's state drug utilization data, which is tracked for the purposes of the Medicaid drug rebate program. But what it does is it gives us a state-by-state, quarter-by-quarter, drug-by-drug accounting of the average costs states are incurring to pay for medications in the Medicaid program. And when you stitched them together, you saw this growing divergence over time that the state was getting charged more while the underlying costs of medicines were going down. Now, we knew pharmacies were getting less and less of a slice of the in-between, so it led us to believe that there was spread pricing going on within the Ohio Medicaid program, spread pricing being the difference between what a PBM pays a pharmacy and then charges their client. We ended up presenting that information to state officials. State officials chose not to digest that information and do anything with it. So we did what we felt was right, which was publish it. We went to the Columbus Dispatch, which is a large newspaper here in Ohio, and we brought it to Robert Langreth over at Bloomberg News nationally. And voila, it prompted multi-year investigation and then an audit from our state auditor in Ohio, Dave Yost. And voila, the crumb trail that we were chasing was directionally accurate. And they found $245 million that PBMs were arbitraging out of the Medicaid program, essentially buying low or paying pharmacies low, billing high, charging the state high, and pocketing the difference. We decided to launch an organization called 46 Brooklyn Research in 2018 that became the publishing home of all those learnings, and not just for Ohio, but every state across the country. That was intended to be what I would just call supplementary to what I was doing at the Pharmacists Association, to essentially start giving people better information about what is an otherwise very opaque and misunderstood transaction. But I didn't real. I'm not really. I never considered myself an entrepreneur, and so really it was meant to be kind of a sandbox of drug pricing journalism. We quickly learned that this is a big deal because a lot of Medicaid programs had no understanding that this was happening. And we also learned that many employers and other government programs also seemed to lack some of the foundational knowledge that I took for granted that many people would understand. And so we decided to launch a consulting firm called Three Axis Advisors in 2019, which was intended to what I would call supplemental income, because we had law firms that were asking for expertise. I had no desire to become a drug pricing consultant in my career. And so I didn't trust my ability to be able to make full-time work out of it, nor did I have an understanding that maybe there was even full-time work available. I quickly learned that that was not the case. Obviously, when you can help uncover millions of dollars in hidden markups, there is a lot of people that would like to eliminate those markups and find ways to pay for them. So fast forward the tape, we run 46 Brooklyn Research as a nonprofit dedicated to making drug pricing data more easily understandable and accessible to the general public. And then with Three Axis Advisors, we do work for employers, provider groups, research firms, advocacy coalitions. We do work for industry disruptors like Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drug Company, Blue Shield of California. And we've also done work for state auditors and state attorney generals and Medicaid programs. Back to 46 Brooklyn, the end goal, you know, I think 46 Brooklyn is to say, I think that it's great that people want to hire us to do work on the consulting side. But I also think that there's enough information in the public domain that maybe you don't need to hire people like us to figure this out. And so I've always believed that to the degree with which secrets are already available in the marketplace, meaning they're not secrets, but they're just kind of, again, inaccessible or misunderstood, it's our belief that if something is already in the public domain, people should have a maximal understanding of it so that we don't become part of the problem, right? If people have to hire us to figure out drug pricing riddles, I would argue that the complexity of the system that necessitates people hiring us or other consultants is arguably more waste in the system.
Awesome. That was a great rundown of kind of how we have gone here with PBMs and kind of your unique insights and expertise into the topic. So really getting into it. Next, can you also summarize how PBMs have come to take such demanding control of the supply chain, in turn becoming one of the most scrutinized entities within healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to first table set that PBMs are providing savings in the marketplace, and they are substantial savings relative to prices charged by manufacturers and pharmacies. But I think that if I just ended there, that would lack a lot of nuance and context that better contextualizes what those savings are. So years ago, government programs started to move in on a philosophy of not solving drug prices for the sake of having unilaterally lower prices in the market, but instead to create specialized discounts for government programs. Between the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Medicaid Drug Rebate Program, we essentially started adopting this philosophy that, well, these are government programs. Why should we pay the full price for drugs? We should get discounts off those drugs. That sounds reasonable, right? Us as taxpayers, we're all paying for it. Why shouldn't the government start getting discounts on medicines? That should help those programs, and it should help us as taxpayers funding those programs. But by moving into the world of discounting, we essentially made a philosophical choice through public policy that we were not going to unilaterally work to create a marketplace conducive to low prices, but instead to start effectuating niche opportunities for certain favored payers to get discounts off of list prices. And after the passage of the Medicaid Drug Rebate Program, we had the passage of the 340B program. We started to expand government discounts. To fast forward the tape now, we're getting into the Inflation Reduction Act. We're also getting discounts in the Medicare program. So whether right or wrong, well-intended or not, this created a market distortion, and it started to erode segments of the marketplace that otherwise would have pharmacies and manufacturers competing to lower prices but instead work to meet the demands of discounts off of list prices. So in a manner of speaking, over time, we have lost our way. Rather than work trying to create an environment of low prices, we have tried to create an environment where we get increasingly larger discounts off of exceedingly inflated prices. That's where PBMs come in. PBMs are now acting as that counterweight against an environment where sticker prices charged by manufacturers and pharmacies are essentially outside of the realm of reasonable and sane. You have very little competition that works to lower the list prices that manufacturers charge for medicines. And because of the ways that PBMs and government programs contracts with pharmacies, pharmacies also have very little incentive to lower their usual and customary prices for what they charge. So as a result, we need somebody to negotiate and create a reasonableness of price, since the market no longer incentivizes that price right out of the gate. And so PBMs are providing massive discounts off of the bogus inflated prices that are being charged in the marketplace. But I would argue that much of those savings are artificial because the prices are artificially inflated to begin with. And PBMs fail in mass to create incentives that change those dynamics, meaning that PBMs continue to perpetuate an environment of inflated list prices and discounts off those list prices, which increases our reliance on them. So for better or worse, PBMs exist to invent and create and negotiate drug pricing reality in a world where prices are otherwise stupid and inflated. And so that reliance creates great power. And if drug pricing reality as a policy concept is intended to be effectuated by these intermediaries, that's why that scrutiny becomes so important. That's why arguably singling them out relative to other layers of the drug supply chain is reasonable. Not because PBMs are the sole villain of high drug prices, by no means are they, but the system itself is reliant upon them to act as that counterweight, which means that their incentives and by extension their results matter far more than the bogus inflated prices that are being charged by the other layers of the supply chain, because the system otherwise incentivizes and begs for their existence.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that was a perfect summary of kind of what PBMs are. The past few years have seen significant movement toward changes within the drug supply chain, from FTC investigations and the PBM practices to Congress's failure to pass PBM reform at the end of last year. There were glimmers of hope along with even more challenges. Can you discuss where we're at right now in terms of PBM reform and how you expect things on the legislative side to unfold throughout the rest of this year?
So I think there's three main buckets of PBM reform. One is legislation, one is litigation, and another is market-based solutions. So let's talk about legislation first. You have federal policy and state policy. At the federal level, there was a massive package of reforms proposed in December 2024 that were ultimately gutted as a result, not of necessarily a taste of the policy, but a distaste of a 1,500-page bill that few people got adequate time to review per lawmakers saying so. That would have delinked PBM compensation off the list prices of drugs, such that they are not incentivized to favor inflated list price products over more efficient ones, and kind of restore them to more of their origin, which is somebody who is supposed to be an uncompromising fighter of high drug prices. If you make money off of higher drug prices, it's poison to the incentive alignment, right? That package would have also banned spread pricing in the Medicaid programs, a la what we found in Ohio back in 2018. And it would have done another of other things in the Medicare program intended to realign the marketplace, restore otherwise misaligned incentives, and then to also create more transparency to employers in the commercial market such that they can better shop for PBM services. While that was deep sixed in December, you now have the Senate Finance Committee saying we want those policies, both bipartisan. You have Energy and Commerce Committee chaired by Brett Guthrie, and then the Health Subcommittee chaired by Buddy Carter, who've all gone on record saying we want this to happen. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said he wanted it to happen at the end of 2024. And you have President Trump saying that they want to go after PBMs as well. So judging people by their words, right, it feels as though there's great momentum within Congress to get at least the 2024 package done. Well, meanwhile, you have other policy solutions that are being proposed by folks like Congresswoman Diana Harshbarger and Congressman Jake Auchincloss, which would build upon some of those reforms around delinking, spread pricing bans, et cetera, and start moving towards some of the other misaligned incentives with PBMs owning their own affiliated pharmacies and setting the payment rates and steering patients, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of momentum at the federal level from a legislative perspective. But in full honesty, I'm not old, but I'm old enough to see this play out many, many times. And while legislators and the executive branch at the federal level talk a big game about PBM reform, I think it is also apparent that this is still very confusing to them, and they don't necessarily have all of the supply chain figured. Few do, even outside of Congress. And so I think that there is motivation to get things done, but I also question the conviction at certain layers of the federal government to actually get those things done, either because of apathy, what I would call maybe theatrical desires for PBM reform, not legitimate, or simply because there's not enough, consensus around some of the policies that are being proposed. Any of those things are possible. At the state level, we're seeing a ton of activity. You have states like West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee that have actually moved to create set payment methodologies within the commercial marketplace for pharmacies, essentially restricting the abilities of PBMs to invent prices in ways that might otherwise favor their affiliated or owned pharmacy companies, much to the disadvantage of unaffiliated companies. You have states that are moving towards rebate pass-through, more transparency requirements upon PBMs. And more recently, you have states like in Indiana and Arkansas, one that recently failed and another one that just went to the governor's desk, that would actually require PBMs to divest ownership of their pharmacy companies, essentially breaking that conflict of interest of PBMs establishing pharmacy networks and then establishing the payment rates for those pharmacy networks when they have an obvious competing interest within their own vertically integrated company. So we see a lot of momentum at the state level. Now, litigation. You have the Federal Trade Commission that has filed a lawsuit against PBMs over their alleged role in inflating the prices of insulin. You have investigations that the FTC is conducting around how, as a vertically integrated company, they might be creating a favorable environment for reimbursements for their affiliated companies. They've released two interim reports that demonstrate that is happening. And certainly we've seen that within our own research as well. You have state attorney generals that have filed lawsuits against PBMs. You have employees of self-funded plans that have filed litigation against their employers over what they allege to be bad PBM contracts that are a violation of the supposed fiduciary duty of that employer to the employee. And you see employers that are getting involved in investigating, auditing, or suing their PBMs over alleged misdeeds as well. And then again, you have states that are firing their PBMs and Medicaid programs, auditing those PBMs, or moving to completely new models like Ohio and Louisiana and West Virginia have done as well. Lastly, there is market-based solutions. As I mentioned, you have plans like Blue Shield of California that are revamping their model. You have Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drug Company, which is a disruptor to some of the legacy ways that PBM business is conducted. You have a number of smaller PBMs that are gaining traction in the marketplace, AffirmedRx, CapitalRx, SmithRx, so on and so on, and more large employers that are moving in those directions or at least starting to consider smaller players where in the past they might not have. You're seeing consultants take a more laser-focused approach to some of the misaligned incentives in the marketplace as well. A good friend of mine, Greg Reibold, who works for the American Pharmacy Cooperative Incorporated, which is an independent pharmacy buying group, he uses the phrase often, pressure bust pipes. And one way or another, I think all of these things could represent reform, but they also may not necessarily be the reform, but they could be the catalyst for reform, right? The more that the marketplace, whether that's reporters, employers, patients, pharmacies, plan sponsors, governments, the more that they understand how the marketplace works, good or bad, the better equipped they are to calibrate that market and create their own environment for reform. And I think it's important to realize that PBMs themselves are starting to, you know, indicate willingness, or at least through words or and actions, or one of the two, or in between, willingness to change, right? You have the big three PBMs. CVS has announced their new True Cost and Cost Vantage program, which is intended to try and create a different scheme of reimbursement that is more cost-oriented, which is where a lot of the pressure of the marketplace is gravitating towards. OptumRx recently announced a similar type of program, and Express Scripts has been doing different types of, you know, niche models as well that are intended to indicate disruptive opportunities for payers and pharmacies as well. Now, obviously, the proof will be in the pudding on those models. But again, reform doesn't just happen by other people forcing it necessarily. Whether legitimate endeavors of change or not, the legacy PBMs are also indicating a possible willingness to evolve from within.
Cool. So basically, by now, many pharmacists and pharmacy employees are familiar with PBMs and their role within the supply chain. But are there any misconceptions about PBMs that continue to circulate that you think pharmacy professionals should be aware of? I mean, basically, like, is there that one thing that people still kind of don't really understand?
Yeah, the one thing I would say, I'll say two things. One is more, I don't know, I'll call it personal in nature. I think pharmacy and pharmacists have arguably a deserved distrust of PBMs and their, you know, integrity and fair dealing with them. As an example, PBMs say, hey, we're great to pharmacists. You know, I think pharmacists are reasonable in saying that's not the case. That's not me saying that one is right or wrong. It's just that I see the numbers. I see how these relationships work. And it is designed to be frictious, right? They're not meant to be, you know, lovers necessarily. They're meant to be Hatfields and McCoys. Pharmacies want to get paid more. PBMs want to pay less. And directionally, that is a good thing. So these are never going to be very happy relationships. And I think in general, it's designed to be that way. But what I will say is that because of that friction, oftentimes that friction becomes personal. And I think that a lot of pharmacists have very villainous opinions of the individuals who work at PBMs and insurance companies. And I think in general, right, there's a little bit of a cultural backlash against insurance companies for other reasons as well. I do think it's important to remember that every individual works at a publicly traded company. It is their fiduciary obligation to make greater returns to shareholders every quarter. And that's just the reality of the business. I've met very many good individuals who work within some of these companies. And the reality is their tasks are explicit. Make more money today than you made yesterday. Does that mean that they are rotten individuals and bad humans? Absolutely not. I can think of a number of very good folks at each one of the logos that most pharmacists do not like, who I think in general are good people. Just because they are as individuals good people, though, does not necessarily excuse what may be, you know, misaligned business models that might work against the interests of the end payer, the consumer, or the provider either. So I think a misconception is that anybody who works at a particular fill-in-the-blank PBM is an inherently rotten person. The second thing that I would say is that a common misconception is that PBMs underpay for everything. They don't. A lot of our research suggests that PBMs will dramatically underpay for what I would call just under a quarter of the things that most pharmacies dispense. They pay at around a break-even or better rate on around 60% of what pharmacies do. And then around 10-15% left over, PBMs wildly overpay for. And that's part of the reason that pharmacies charge such high usual and customary prices. Because PBMs engage in wildly disparate reimbursement from one drug to the next and one pharmacy to the next, there are contractual mechanisms that tell the pharmacy we'll never pay you more than your usual and customary price. So if you tell the pharmacy you'll never pay more than what you bill them, you underpay for some things, pay reasonably for other things, and wildly overpay for others. What that means is that the pharmacy business model is heavily reliant upon wildly overpaid claims to make the overall math work. So again, a misconception that I think pharmacists, you know, will convey largely because they focus on, understandably, focus on negativity in an otherwise knit aggregate environment, is that PBMs don't underpay for everything. They overpay for some things. What our research typically shows is that the things that they overpay for are the things that are being disproportionately filled at the pharmacies they own. The last thing I'll say about misconceptions, a lot of pharmacists will allege that PBMs are underpaying for brand name drugs. In general, that is true. Typical market conditions that we examine show that PBMs are providing very low rates of compensation for brand name drugs relative to what they will do on the generic side. That is not only a PBM problem, though. The distorting effects of 340B are starting to undermine some of the reimbursement mechanisms. So let me explain really quick. It is a PBM's job to find essentially the lowest rate possible that the market will tolerate. If half of pharmacies, we have about roughly half of pharmacies are either contract pharmacies or covered entities operating within the 340B program, which means that they are getting access to much lower acquisition costs for drugs than an average pharmacy who's not operating within that program. If over half of pharmacies essentially have this cushion of a low acquisition cost that other pharmacies are not able to get, that means the aggregate pharmacy marketplace is exhibiting a tolerance for brand reimbursements that may seem ridiculous to some pharmacies, but are tolerable to others. So 340B is creating a distortion in the marketplace that is allowing PBMs to a degree to get away with what many pharmacies would be considered totally unsustainable and unreasonable reimbursements on brand drugs. So important consideration that pharmacy headwinds on margin are not solely attributed to PBMs underpaying for drugs, although that is the root cause, but 340B is creating a market tolerance that is allowing for some of that aggressive reimbursement bandwidth on the PBM side.
Well, that's all I have for you today, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Hey, great to be with you, Brian. Thank you.